real time across the local folks that are there organizing and protesting. And worldwide, of course, this has a lot of different implications for a lot of different protest movements, but also for democracy organizing, human rights work, refugee camps, etc.
I wanted to find out what the response is from the telecom industry. AT&T not wanting this to be an issue right now because of telecom policy, saying this kind of tech should be allowed. Explain.
Sure. Well, you can imagine if you're a small business, in the same way that you might buy a single internet connection and share it across all of your computers in your office. This is normal today to do this. What we're saying is, well, let's take advantage of that same kind of functionality and allow for people within, say, your office to make free phone calls to one another, to make free text messaging to one another. Huge cost savings. It challenges this business model that everyone has to buy their own internet connection. And it really puts forward this notion of, well, why don't we share resources? We can share them across our neighbors. We can share them within our offices. We can share them across entire cities. And in so doing, dramatically lower the costs for individual users to access communications.
So teens texting for free?
Teens texting for free, yes. If your tween and all of their friends download this software, they can text for free in their school, dramatically benefiting parents all across the country.
Sasha, we just have a minute left. Where do you see decentralized communications going and the challenging of corporations and the state? Although you are funded by the state, how do they feel about the work you're doing here?
Sure. So we're incredibly transparent for obvious reasons about where our funding comes from. It comes from a variety of different sources. For us, the real import of this work is that communications, the free flow of communications, is fundamental to democracy. Without it, you cannot have participatory democracy. And so what we're really working on is a next iteration of participatory democracy with this technology.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Sasha Meinrath, Director of the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute, launching this new software at commotionwireless.net. We are streaming from the Freedom to Connect conference all day today at democracynow.org. Special thanks to our crew here at Freedom to Connect, David Eisenberg, Paul Hyland, Paul Franz, Paul Bringer, and here at AFI Silver, Eileen Keegan, Tiffany Graham Golden, and John Summers. Democracy Now! Produced by Renee Fels, Aramante Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkafani Masood, Ravi Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Julie Crosby, Elizabeth Press, Karen Renucci. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us from Silver Spring. Democracy Now! Is a listener-supported grassroots global news hour. You make it possible when you donate at democracynow.org. Thank you so much.
This is Donna with your WUSB concert billboard for Sunday, March 3rd. Eileen Ivers and Immigrant Soul will be at the Bolton Center in Bayshore, 7 p.m. The West Hampton Beach Performing Arts Center presents Cowboy Junkies at 8 p.m. Hinder will be at the Emporium. Baroque Sundays at 3 will be at the Stoller Center for the Arts at the Stoller Center Recital Hall, 3 p.m. Travis McKevany will be at the Grey Horse Tavern, 1 p.m. Suzanne Vega will be at the Bell House in Brooklyn, 8 p.m. Your concert billboard for Monday, March 4th. Strawberry Fields will be at B.B. King's. And on the billboard for Tuesday, March 5th, Slam Donahue will be at the Brooklyn Bowl, 8 p.m. Looking ahead to Wednesday, March 6th, The Howling Winds will be at Spike Hill in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Pink Fraud will be at the Patchogue Theater, live in the lobby, 7:30. Lewis Hayes and the Cannonball Adderley Legacy Band will be at Iridium. Lewis Hayes and the Cannonball Adderley Legacy Band will be at Iridium. From huge arenas to intimate coffee houses, you'll hear who's performing inside them on WUSB's concert billboard, both on air and online at wusb.fm/CBP.
Well, thanks there, Donna. And of course, it is 6:01 in the p.m. on a Tuesday night, which can only mean one thing. Thank you.
And you're listening to Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi.
We are actually coming to you on tape this week, as we are somewhere else. And this show was recorded about 10 months ago. I realize almost a year ago it was recorded, in the spring of 2012. We are going to be standing in the streets of London with our friends Zap, Crypt, and Bob. And where in London did we record this, Kyle?
Right in front of the Parliament building near a river, and right under Big Ben.
Yeah, so you'll hear Big Ben chiming every now and then. Something else we should also point out, since this was recorded such a long time ago, any references to the upcoming Olympics should be probably disregarded because, well, obviously the Olympics are not upcoming anymore. And also any reference towards the end of the program towards a hacker camp in England that will be taking place later in the year, well, that took place last year. But there will be another one taking place in 2014, so perhaps we could get enthusiastic about that, and perhaps also get enthusiastic about the Dutch hacker camp coming up called Ohm. But we'll be talking to you a lot more about that in upcoming shows. For now, I guess, just enjoy the program, which comes to you from the spring of 2012 in the streets of London.
It was really good. There's a lot of great conversation.
Oh, yes.
All right.
Go ahead.
Let's not mention the sounds of Big Ben if we hear them.
Okay.
All right. Because we're standing here in London.
There we go.
Yeah, you see, that's what I mean.
So what am I not supposed to mention?
Refer to the sound.
You're mentioning it.
All right. Well, it's over now. And the fact.
We got loads more.
It's the half hour one.
Yeah. Well, it's the half hour one. What it does, it goes. There's four different kinds. And that you just heard two chimes, or two, whatever you call those things, choruses?
Yeah.
Bongs. No, those aren't bongs.
Bongs is something entirely different. We won't mention that here, but...
All right, well, so you have two at the half hour, three at the three-quarter hour, and on the hour you get four plus the gongs. Not bongs, gongs.
Yeah.
All right.
We can tell you a toast because you know. We don't even know.
The whole world knows. It's not hard to know how a clock sounds.
You're entirely right. Everybody in the world knows, except people from London who don't know.
Well, the other thing is that everyone assumes you can hear Big Ben throughout the entire city, and you can really only hear it for about a block because it's so loud, all the cars and traffic and tourists. We're standing by a million tourists here screaming and making commotion and things like that.
Including some very weird people dressed as Jack Sparrow and Darth Vader and Shrek.
Shrek, the devil, Fiona.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure what that's all about, but there's a lot of silliness going on. And of course, across the river, there's the Eye, which is a massive Ferris wheel. Now, let me just ask, how many of you three have been on the Eye?
I haven't.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, I have.
All right, well, you two are true Londoners. I don't know where you're from.
From Luton.
Uh-huh, you see, there you go. That's how you tell. That's how you tell what people are... Of course, I'm a tourist, so I was on it once. And, well, you know, being on it, that it's not called a ride, it's called a flight.
If you say so.
You weren't paying any attention, were you? It was like, it's like being on an airplane. That's how they... try and make it sound.
It goes so slowly, you can't really fly anywhere. It's just like a little, like about 1 meter a second or something like that.
Yeah, it takes about an hour to make one circle because everyone's getting off. And you can fit like 20 people in the car, which makes it a lot of fun.
Did you go on it at night or in the day?
I think I went on it right about at dusk.
Because at night, if you have a nice clear night, you can see for miles and miles.
Oh, that's interesting. I'll probably never go on it again, but it's good to know. And Kyle, of course, you're here. You've never been on the Eye.
No, I've never been on it.
And you probably never will.
No, never ever.
It's massively high, and
the capsules look like a spaceship or something. It's really bizarre.
Yeah, it's strange.
I mainly wouldn't want to be captive. I wouldn't want to be up there and like stuck in it because I figure after about 10 minutes I get really like sick of it and then try to get off and you can't. Anyway.
Well, we've been wandering around looking at these various... I mean, we're not just going to look at these sites. They just happen to pop up wherever we happen to be. And London's got all kinds of activity going on. For instance, we went out to see the Olympic Park yesterday. And that's... what do you think, Kyle?
Oh, man. It's really, really cool. It's all brand new, like brand new architecture. They're really busy over there building stuff. They've got like new lines, like new train lines, a new... I don't know, all sorts of extra streets. They're putting up some temporary, some semi-permanent. I don't even know. It's tough to tell, but basically they've built this enormous mall. It's, I guess, the third largest mall in the UK, and they're basically going to build out a city out of it. They're calling it Stratford City, and it's adjacent to where all the Olympic Park is going to be, which obviously is a mix of like sort of permanent stadiums and then like more semi-permanent structures. So it was really intriguing to walk around there to see like sort of where they're still working, where they're letting people in, like what kinds of monitoring they're doing, how they're controlling entry, and sort of what it's going to be like, what the flow of people is going to be like. Seeing the mall just in and of itself was pretty impressive when you realize that a good part of the world is going to be descending upon that area, and that mall is going to be sort of the hub of activity for everything not related to watching the games.
So yeah, lots of stores I'd never heard of before, lots of food courts and three stories, I think, altogether. It's huge, and I don't know how they did it so quickly. But when you think about it, New York was in the competition for the Olympics along with London, so whatever happened here could have happened there, I suppose. I just don't see it being as smooth over there. I don't see brand new buildings and new train lines and things like that like they did here.
Wait, I'm sorry, I missed what you said. Right?
No, that's not for Euro, for the Olympics.
What's not smooth? Wait, what's not smooth? It's pretty smooth to me. It's only been up for a year, and the mall is, like, in full effect on a Sunday?
Yeah, I'm talking about New York. New York, I don't think, would have been able to do that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I missed the distinction you're making. Yeah, absolutely. No, New York, I don't think they haven't been able to get their stuff together in hundreds of years for just life. So, I honestly don't think they would have been able to do much for the Olympics, and that's why it's in London.
Of course, Seattle probably couldn't have done much better.
I'm not sure, actually. I think America is perfectly capable of building malls if it needs to, you know. And it's actually really interesting that they built a mall there, and they're building all this sort of like large shops and everything, and they're having huge branding. It's all this stuff that they've built just to sell things to people, you know,
for the Olympics.
And it's like the actual Olympic Stadium is all just a tiny little part of it. Sports is actually a tiny little part of it. They've just built all this stuff to sell things so they can make money, you know. And it's been quite interesting recently because we've had the Olympic torch relay going around Britain, and they get people, general sort of like community volunteers, and lots of people, decent people, to go round with the Olympic torch, and then they give them this replica Olympic torch afterwards. Now, there's been a big controversy recently because they've been selling all their torches on eBay for like hundreds of thousands of pounds, and all of them saying like, how on earth could they do this? How could they make money out of the Olympics? And then you've got Coca-Cola and McDonald's and a huge mall built to make money out of the Olympics, and they're sort of like they're rounding on the community volunteers that want to sell their torches for hundreds of thousands of pounds just to spend on like stuff they've been doing for their communities. So there's a giant contradiction within the Olympics and the whole rampant commercialism that's going on around it. But yeah, I mean, some of the structures are pretty impressive. So
the interesting thing there is torchbearers are not allowed to sell their torches. However, the Olympic Committee, to recover costs from the manufacture of torches, afterwards is kind of allowed to sell one more. So you can't sell one if you buy it, but if, because you have to buy your own torch for, is it £200, £199?
And that's a replica, right?
But they can sell originals. That's the one you run with.
So you pay £199 for the privilege of running with a torch that you get to keep.
Yeah.
No. You get to run with it, but you don't get to keep it. But if you pay the £199, you get to keep it. But you're not allowed to sell it. But if you don't buy it, they can sell it.
Now, wait a minute. How do I get to be a runner? How does that work?
You have to apply.
You would have to apply for that one in advance.
Generally, they pick them from like community volunteers, people that have done good for the local community. Because they're all going all around Britain, and they want to highlight sort of like good causes that have been going on around the communities around Britain. So they hire kind of like people from that to run with the torch to highlight what they've been doing.
And how far does every runner go?
I think it's about 200 or 300 meters.
That's it?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of handing off going on.
Yeah, pretty much. It's very short distance they all run, so they can get as many people in as possible, basically.
Unless your name is Will.i.am, the American singer.
Okay.
Then he gets to run too.
Because he's Will.i.am.
Of course.
No, that's really dead on, you guys. The fact that the commercialization of it, I mean, seeing the mall, you realize, wow, you know, I mean, this is a lot of branding, and the corporate side of this plays a big part. I mean, they talk about economic, you know, the vitalization and how the Olympics bring that, you know, people from around the world and all this trade and stuff like that. but you know, it's really sort of it's not supporting much locally because all those companies are basically taking profits and you know they'll move it elsewhere. I guess I read that there were 10,000 jobs at this mall, but only about 2,000 that were local permanent positions, which I thought was a bit weird. Meaning 7,000 of those jobs are from like elsewhere. That people are going to be commuting in. So I don't know. It's pretty bizarre. Interesting about the Torch, though, that they can sell the originals, but if you pay, then you can keep the one and prevent them essentially from selling it. That's fascinating.
No. It's worse than that. If you pay for it,
what?
You are not allowed to sell it. So these people who've been selling their Torches on eBay, this is what the fuss has been about. But most people haven't been getting. I mean, the person who got £100,000 on eBay, the person's not going to pay for that. You know, someone won a £100,000 auction, but no one's going to pay for that. When all the other Torches are going for like £1,000. So you make some money on it.
Hmm. How do they enforce not selling in the first place?
They don't. They've done a big U-turn.
Well, no, they haven't officially. They still say you can't sell it, and they say they might come after these people, but I think they're kind of more kind of turning a blind eye to it. But...
Well, now, we talked to Cory Doctorow about some of the things going on at the Olympics. One thing that seemed really disturbing was that apparently you guys passed some kind of a law that allows the police to go into someone's flat without a warrant to tear down an anti-Olympic poster. Is this true?
Yes. I haven't heard that one, but there are some very sort of like stringent laws going on. Basically, you know, anything that could be construed as being to do with the Olympics that's being shown in public would be torn down by police immediately and you get banned. There was someone who tried to cover up one of the posters on the Olympic torch route. He's been arrested and he's facing 5 years in jail for just covering up a poster. But yeah.
What did the poster say?
It was just a sponsorship poster from Coca-Cola or something like that along the torch route. And he got arrested and they're trying to charge him under this new law. And I think the maximum penalty under the new law is 5 years in jail. But, you know, I don't think he'll get 5 years in jail. It would be a huge travesty of justice if it happened. But still, I mean, he is facing the possibility of 5 years in jail for covering up a poster, which is just ridiculous.
And also, you're not allowed to mention the Olympics and London in any profitable or non-profitable media. You can't. Is it London? And
oh, wait, whoa, whoa! We have to stop then. This is a radio show, a non-profit radio, and we're talking about that. We can't do that.
Oh, but we don't have a logo.
I'm sorry.
We don't have a logo.
Oh, yes, we do.
Can I see the logo?
It was the five of us in rings.
If we kind of just
we designed it right before this, didn't you see us drawing on the sidewalk?
If we all form circles with our hands in rings and sort of like just walk up straight like that, that might actually be a breach of the law and we could just approach a policeman and see if he'd arrest us for it. I don't know.
I don't know. Isn't the logo with 2012 or something a bit obscene? It looks like Lisa Simpson doing an obscene act, allegedly. I don't know. Does anyone want to get on their knees? We have a logo. I don't know.
That's going a little bit too far, right?
Well, there's a structure on the site that looks like a roller coaster that fell off a plane. What's that all about?
Oh, I think that's a restaurant. I don't think it's actually a roller coaster, but. It's new, I don't know. We'd have to wait to see if it actually...
They're coming for us. You can hear that they're coming.
They're good,
for
they're
us.
Pretty good.
Yeah, we mentioned the Olympics. I think they're coming to bust us, but yeah. Yeah, I believe that's a restaurant. That's close to the Olympic Stadium. I was down there a few weeks
ago. I'd be afraid to go up there. It's pretty high up, and it doesn't look like there's... it's very structurally sound.
But the London Eye, I think, is taller, isn't it?
Well, I'm afraid to go up there, too. Didn't say I wasn't.
Well, the good news is, it's sturdy British engineering.
Made by Germans, I think. Something like that.
I think it's some kind of ride. I don't know. It's called like the Orbit or something. I don't know. I haven't looked into it much, but it's some sort of a ride, or you go up and observe. I don't know really what's going on, but it's a bit bizarre compared to some of the more like you know traditional athletic structures and stuff like that. So it's interesting.
Like most of these sorts of grand events, these big white elephants, like we had the Millennium Dome just a decade ago.
Where is that? I didn't see that.
North Greenwich.
North Greenwich. If you watch EastEnders, you'll see it on the logo. No one understands why half the stuff is happening, and more interestingly, most Londoners don't actually seem to want the Olympics here.
Well, it's a little late for that, isn't it?
Well, we weren't asked.
We weren't asked either. New York was in competition for this, and we weren't, but we were against it, from most people I know, anyway.
It's a big chunk of change, and most people in London, if you actually survey them, they are not interested, and they also don't want the disruption. We're going to have 6 weeks of not being able to get anywhere, because all the swanky hotels are in the west of London, so that's where the nice people will be staying with loads of money, and the games are in the east, and there are no good roads or rail links between them. So they're shutting down roads just so that VIPs and athletes can go down them. They're closing lanes, so they're not entirely shutting down roads, but in town they're even shutting roads, but they're not even telling us which ones they're closing yet. It's going to be chaos.
Yeah. The other thing is they've got special lanes, which I think they've got special traffic lights, saying that the cars have got special devices, which allows them to bypass the traffic lights, so I've heard. So if you drive in that lane, you'll get fined. Even ambulances are not allowed to go in that lane. So it's going to be chaos.
They're going to pull over an ambulance and give it a ticket?
I think someone's putting a leg there. I haven't heard that story myself.
We'll see. We'll see when it happens, because everyone's been up in arms. In fact, everyone's been trying to get a cut, make money out of the Olympics. You've got like train drivers that need the extra money or something they were fighting for because they might have to work or extra hours.
Oh, we have strikes to look forward to.
Strikes.
More strikes.
And basically, once the train drivers got the money, the bus drivers wanted it. Once the bus drivers got it, the taxi drivers wanted it. So everyone's trying to get a cut from the Olympics. So yeah, money, money, money.
Well, now after it's all done, what happens to all these structures? Like you have a brand new Olympic stadium. What is it that who's going to play in there?
Well, I believe maybe a football or soccer team will be using one of them, but that's also controversy as well, because what happens to these buildings, because they're not really going to sport communities or anything like that that I've heard of, so they're just going to be derelict or empty, and they'll try and find a use for it after the event, but it's a lot of money spent like on the Millennium Dome, that once it was done after the Millennium, they didn't know what to do with the building.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was quite an interesting story with what they were actually going to do with the main stadium, because originally they had this big tender process, and the two main clubs that were trying to sort of like move in were Tottenham and West Ham. West Ham won the tender, Tottenham started suing them. They won the court case to mean that West Ham couldn't move in, but the court case also said that Tottenham couldn't move in, which kind of like just throws everything out. But there was an interesting loophole where as long as like Newham Council kept the actual ownership of the ground, they could lease it out to West Ham. So they went through this whole bid, and then that got thrown out again. So now it's been thrown into this huge sort of like, we don't know what's going to happen with it, we ain't got no use for it, it's just going to sit there and nobody's going to be able to use it, which kind of sucks.
So of the two teams, West Ham United, Tottenham Hotspur, I believe?
Yes.
Which one is closest?
West Ham is closest.
All right, they get it then. That's simple as that.
Well, they should do. I mean, the ground is pretty crappy right now, so, you know, it's... but, yeah, I mean, it would be a good ground for a football team to move into, but, you know, it's just legal problems and all this sort of stuff that somehow the courts have said they can't move in. But, I don't know.
Wow. Well, controversy and mayhem here in London on the eve of the Olympics, and it'll be interesting to see what happens. But, you know, the reason why Kyle and I are here, not at all for the Olympics, we were here to look at surveillance throughout England. Get some pictures for the new calendar. And England, London, it's a mecca for surveillance. Are you guys used to it at all? It just seems to be everywhere. I mean, right now, is there a camera watching us? Let's look around.
There's got to be a camera watching us. I can't see it at the moment, but there must be somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere there's a camera. I mean, not counting the building surrounding us, which probably has something pointed downwards. This would be amazing if we found the one area that doesn't have a camera.
Yeah. I think we have found a blind spot in London.
All right, we're not going to say where we are.
Yeah, otherwise they put a camera on it.
But in fairness, we can see cameras. I can see two right now for like a bit of a dock here for some sort of a riverboat. And then, of course, as you said, there's some on buildings. And boy, we've done quite a tour. We've seen all kinds of different cameras and surveillance. Just ways of keeping track and having record of things. We've learned a lot about schemes and the difference between like systems that are controlled by public institutions, like rail stations, you know, public transport, government, protecting, you know, security buildings, stuff like that, and then private schemes.
When you say scheme, what does that mean?
Yeah, I guess a scheme is like, from my understanding of it, I could be wrong, you guys can correct me, but a scheme is whoever sort of installed and then operates or monitors the system Now, in the U.S., it's sort of like if you want surveillance, you just go buy the gear and plug it into a VCR and do it. Same here. I mean, there are private places that would get their own surveillance, plug it in, and you know, monitor privately. But then, so you would describe that as a sort of private scheme. And some, obviously, since security cameras are so prevalent here, there's industries, right? There's different companies that then are involved in sort of installing and operating schemes for people because, you know, if you don't want to get the equipment, you don't want to monitor it, you don't want to deal with backing up or recording, or, as is the case here in the UK, sending people copies of them being surveilled. Because upon request, and I learned this during the trip, anyone, even a visitor, can request the scheme operator to send them clips of them being surveilled. And that's part of sort of a FOIA-like, a freedom of information, but it's not quite the same. It's unique and distinct for the UK. So in any event, there's many different schemes, both public, government-run, and also private or, you know, commercial schemes. And that was informative, but we've seen all kinds of them. And there's a lot of signs, and often the signs will say, this scheme is controlled by who, you know, such and such, and the contact info. Sometimes there's even barcodes. You can go to the website and order your scheme and have clips sent to you sort of without even talking to anyone personally. So that's something I've noticed. But there's also other stuff, you know, sensors to see if a vehicle is too tall, or I don't even know, charging zones. We would see clusters of fixed cameras, ones that don't move. And we've seen a lot of different cameras, ones that are mobile, ones that move around, entire trucks that are mobile, ones with teeny tiny little windshield wipers, as we saw when we walked by some of the...
MI6.
MI6, yeah. You said it, not me. Well, wait, I did. No, I said it. We both said it. All right, never mind. Anyway, but yeah, I mean, it's all kinds of sensing and the fixed ones I was referring to are for charge zones when you're driving. So, like, if you're in the wrong lane, you'll be recorded. Also, there's speed cameras, just as what's actually blowing up in the U.S. In Seattle alone, we've seen a lot of speed cameras of different types. They're getting smaller and sort of cheaper so that, you know, like, there's a school district in where my folks live that they just bought sort of all-in-one unit, threw it up on a pole, and, like, that's theirs, scheme. But then again, like, a lot of cities, I guess, in New York, a lot of cities are buying, like, full systems that have, you know, the real, like, mast and, you know, metal enclosures. And here, they've been around for quite some time, so the enclosures are very sort of sturdy and industrial-looking, and it's fascinating just to see the different types and to see the way it's implemented. So, yeah, it's been really a whirlwind of an education, at least for me. So I don't know what you thought. Have you been amazed as I have?
Yeah, I've seen it before, but it's getting more and more sophisticated and prevalent. But you guys live here, so, I mean, are you used to it?
Well, you do kind of get used to it now. It's like you have to sort of like prepare for everywhere you go, you're on camera. It doesn't matter. If you're in a public place, you're on camera. If you're in a shop, you're on camera. If you're in anywhere like that's remotely public, that's not your own home, congratulations, you're being filmed. But yeah, it's interesting with the like freedom of information requests that you can actually do. There was a time a long time ago, about like 4 or 5 years ago, where, you know, a lot of people were doing this to try and just kind of like get back at people, sort of like try and stop people doing surveillance by requesting absolutely everywhere they've been. But the government's kind of cut back on that now. By there's a loophole that people can get out of that by saying it's not reasonably possible to
isolate. People would jam it. They would try to you know, jam up the system with a bunch of requests and stuff like that. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, there was a comedian called Mark Thomas who ran a competition several years ago, and what he got people to do was act out scenes from movies under surveillance cameras and then request the actual film of them doing it, which was actually pretty popular, and like there's loads of films on YouTube you can go and see for people doing that. But because of this and because of this campaign, the government have now said that if it's not reasonably possible within sort of like a certain sort of like financial constraint to send you the information, the company doesn't have to do it. So, you know, it's interesting some of the workarounds they get around this law, but it's certainly something that we've got to try and fight to get back that right to see yourself on camera. Because, I mean, it's perfectly reasonable that if you're on a camera, you should be able to request that film of you being on camera. I mean, come on. This is a democracy, surely, not a police state. Well, yeah.
Okay. One thing I would just add to that, I think with freedom of information requests, there can also be charges associated where they'll pass a fee on, so £10 admin fee, processing the clip request. Is that correct?
It used to be a maximum of £10. I think they've put it up to, what, 20 now, is it?
It's £10, but it's not in freedom of information. It's data protection. Ah,
yes. Gets you you're correct.
And it's a maximum of £10. So for a price of £10, you can have some fun getting the film.
Yeah, yeah.
But that would be £10 for each request.
And a request that was successfully fulfilled, or just the request, even if they didn't come up with anything?
That I actually don't know.
I think they have to get you the footage. Whether they say they wouldn't be able to get the footage because it would incur too much of a cost, or they can't identify you. Because don't forget, you've got a problem with privacy from other people that are caught in the film. So they'd have to try and block those people out or eliminate them from somehow, or I don't know. But if that's too expensive to do, you're not going to get the footage.
So now, who are the people watching all of this footage? Does anyone have any idea? Do you know any people?
A lot of it is private security firms, some sort of like government set up schemes to monitor CCTV. There's various different entities that do it, and sometimes finding out which entity has your footage can be quite a chore.
Well, let's say just walking down the street or in a public train station, it's not a private entity, is it? It's the government, right?
Most of it's government on some of them on train stations, but a lot of the time the government will farm it out to private security firms. So sometimes getting the data can be a bit of a problem.
Train station is actually private property, so it would be the railway companies. Okay. Anywhere on the street is the council. Anywhere that's like, for example, the Trocadero is private property, would be a private security firm. But mainly on the street is the council's, which is linked to either a control centre or the police station.
And how long do they keep the footage?
That's a good question. It depends on the places.
But yeah, a lot of the time the council will actually hire out private security as well, so, you know, getting it from them. Again.
Now, as far as how secure this keeps you, I mean, I know after the 7/7 bombings, they were able to see the people, but they had already blown things up, and it probably wouldn't have been too hard to figure out who they were, so it didn't prevent anything. Yeah, has there been any example of it preventing crime?
To be honest, they did an investigation, and they found out that for millions and millions of pounds spent, but they hadn't been effective in preventing crime at all. It was below 1%, I believe. But they do use it as a massive data log. So they'll say, well, we totally missed the crime because no one's watching the cameras. We can't afford people to watch every camera, so we give each individual member of staff 200-odd cameras to watch. So they missed the crime, but then someone reports the crime, and you've got evidence there. So it is of some use.
But depending on the quality of the picture, it depends if that's going to be used in court and whether it's going to be actually enough to get a conviction. But cameras don't prevent crime, and it's very hard to get a conviction from the footage they have because it depends on the quality.
My wife worked a gang murder case in the UK, in London, and they got 30-odd people on CCTV. Like, they were kind of all dressed in black, and they all looked the same. So the footage wasn't of any use at all. If it wasn't for the new DNA technology that was used in that case, which was using animal DNA, they wouldn't have secured any convictions.
Now, I guess most of your lives living here, you've had to deal with this surveillance that's taken over. Can you each think of an example of maybe something that happened in your lives that wouldn't have happened the same way were there not surveillance cameras? Maybe you changed your behavior, you did something differently, or maybe somebody accused you of something because of surveillance, or maybe you accused somebody else of something. I imagine there must be lots of stories of things that occurred. Anyone?
Yeah, I've got a story. Being a hacker, I'm a suspicious character, maybe, I don't know.
You are.
Yeah, okay. Being in a store, I was accused of shoplifting, and it was enough to get mall security down. They wanted to drag me off. They wanted to look in my bag, which I refused because it's an invasion of my privacy. So basically, I said, like, check the CCTV. And after some humming and hurrying, they checked the CCTV and did actually find that I was not shoplifting. But this was like weeks after the event, and only because I went through customer services. So it does help in that way. I've also got another experience, same sort of scenario with another store, where the police actually alleged that I actually did steal something when I know I didn't. But I didn't get the footage, even though I asked for it, so...
But they never charged you with anything?
No, because they have a zero tolerance, and I'm not a thief. So if I had taken something, I'm sure I would have been arrested, and they didn't arrest me.
Okay, you have a story?
Well, not one that's anything CCTV change bay, but you're always aware of it. You're always kind of like thinking, where can you go where there's not CCTV? But yeah, I mean, like about a year ago, like I was actually mugged and had the phone not stolen off me. But it was quite crazy because the thieves, they knew exactly where the CCTV cameras were, and they got me in the blind spots. So you don't actually prevent crime, you just get people to be a bit more sensible about where the cameras are. But you know, the thieves and anyone that wants to do nasty stuff knows where the cameras are, and they'll deliberately go out the way to miss them. So it's quite useless really having the cameras there.
I heard that said, that actually the crime simply moves into the forest or out of the town. And in fact, if you read 1984, that's exactly what happened there, where Winston and Julia went out into the forest away from the telescreens and all the monitoring. Of course, they were being monitored anyway, but I imagine it's just a matter of time before the cameras are everywhere and you can't hide.
Yeah, but you don't even have to go out of the town. So you just have to go down a side street. And you just have to be a bit sensible about where the cameras are. You know, so they're not everywhere. They're very sort of like visible and they're very sort of like active, especially in central London. But if you go sort of like even half a mile outside the main city, then you know you've got areas where there aren't CCTV cameras, and you're going to get sort of like people. You get the crime happening in those areas instead of the main areas. So
you believe there should be more cameras everywhere?
No, it's just crazy that people rely on them, you know, to actually solve crime.
But had there been a camera in that side street, the muggers wouldn't have attacked.
Sure, but then again, if there hadn't been cameras anywhere, the police might have been a bit more active in actually, rather than spending the money on hundreds of thousands of pounds on cameras to give some sort of like false sense of security, get policemen out there solving crime, which gives you the real sense of security of actually doing something. But then again, you know, I'm not one to advocate increasing police presence everywhere either, so I don't know.
Bob, any stories about cameras or surveillance?
ANPR is all I'll say. Automatic number plate recognition.
Oh, tell us about those.
This is starting a bit in the US.
I don't know if it's on all police cars in this country, because obviously every force is independent and they can do whatever they will within the law. But ANPR is fitted to police cars to identify the number plate and then find out whether it's got tax, insurance, any outstanding issues with that vehicle, whether it's reported stolen. The local authorities have been driving down the side roads with it to see if your car is insured and taxed. And also it's appearing on petrol station forecourts, or gas station forecourts as you'd call them, all over the country. So once someone steals some petrol or diesel, some fuel, they can be caught, is the idea behind it.
Amazing. It's also used for the congestion charge in London, correct?
Yes, it is.
Tell something about that. What is that all about?
Congestion charge. Surely you have charging zones in America?
Oh, no, we don't. Not in New York, anyway. There was talk about maybe doing it, but they couldn't figure out how.
It's quite simple, really. Central London, you couldn't drive down any roads. So they thought they'll charge a tax for every motorist driving through the area, which will make the roads free again. And it didn't work. But we've kept it. And we keep increasing the charges. Maybe one day people won't need to drive to where they need to get to, but I kind of think not.
So how does it actually work? Who do you pay? When do you pay? What happens if you don't pay?
You can pay for the whole year up front, or you can actually pay by day. There's a number you dial, you give it your credit card numbers, and that's it. You don't get a piece of paper, you don't get a ticket or anything. You can even do it in shops. You can say, you know, give me...
voucher,
yeah,
ticket.
It's just basically sort of like going to a shop, tell them your registration number, and pay them the money, and they'll sort of put it on the computer for you. So I think most sort of like off licenses do it around here.
Is it expensive?
I think, how much is it a day now?
I think it's £8 a day. Is it £10 a day? I use vehicles for work, which pay by the year, so on a daily basis, I don't know. Oh, and also, if you don't know you're going into town. So you're driving around, and I've just cut into the congestion charging zone, and you're going to get a fine. But they've introduced this basically you can pay within 24 hours. So if you realise you drove down the wrong road or something like that, you can actually pay within 24 hours and avoid the fine, which is very handy, because I've been fined just not realising I drove down the wrong road.
How do you know when you've driven down the road? Does something beep, or is there any way to tell?
Your car explodes. there's a red circle with a white C on the ground.
And I've seen that. I've seen
that.
And
there's cameras. But there's no barrier. So if you're, you know, on your phone or trying to eat a slice of pizza or something while driving, or doing both at the same time, it's very easy to miss.
Is it legal to talk on the phone and drive at the same time?
Well, not in this country, no.
So they could take a picture of you doing that and make another ticket for you?
They could.
Giving them ideas here.
Unless you have a hands-free kit. If you're holding your mobile, yes, you're breaking the law. But if you've got a hands-free kit, then you should be okay. But driving while talking, distracting, I wouldn't recommend it.
And also eating a pizza while you're driving, while on the phone at the same time, is probably going to land you a bit of a fine.
Wow. You've got that. I heard something on the news the other day about insurance discounts being offered to drivers who agree to have a video camera installed in their cars, I guess to watch them at all times to see what they're up to.
I think this is more of like a black box that tells you the speed you're driving at, what you're driving, and how you're braking. This is more for youngsters to lower their premiums for the insurance.
But it was an actual camera.
This is a camera. I suppose black box for a car. So, yeah, if it lowers your insurance, then it may be value for money, but personally, I wouldn't want that.
And the radio commentators were discussing the controversy about this. Nothing to do with privacy, just had to do with the cost. The insurance was too high. It cost too much money. Nobody seemed to care that there's a video camera watching your every move in your own car.
If I can just make a quick comment on CCTV in this country. We're very apathetic in this country, and especially in London, we just don't care. And I think everyone around this group here has gotten used to it, and it's just a fact of life. And that's for us. Most citizens couldn't care less. They couldn't care less.
Yeah, it's a sad state, really. I think we need to probably sort of like be a bit more active on saying to people, hey, look, it's people watching everything you do. You can't literally just pick your nose without someone watching it on a CCTV camera. This is just a bit ridiculous, yet we've gotten so used to it. We're just so apathetic now. I think we need to try to change people's opinions a bit, but then again, how do you do that?
Yeah, guys, you speak for yourself. I mean, it's like going against the tide. I mean, I'm not very keen on the cameras, especially for what they're saying. It's to prevent crime, it's to stop suspicious behaviour and things like that. In the end, it doesn't really do it. So it's just an invasion of privacy.
But it does change the way that you think and you feel and you act as people who live here. It makes you realise you're always being watched and scrutinised. It's got to mess you up somehow.
I think the average citizen they see it as a positive thing. That they don't see it as their privacy is dead. They see it as, this is something that will keep me safe. In this country, we love the nanny state. We love our hand being held, whether we need it or not. And I think most citizens would actually think it's a benefit, and they think they feel safer, even if they don't.
But what is the danger? It doesn't seem like a particularly dangerous country. I mean, if you compare things like firearm deaths in this country compared to the U.S., it's such a small number. Violence, yeah, there's violence with violence everywhere. But why do people here seem so obsessed with safety?
Crime, it's always a perception issue. So we could have 100th the crime in America, but have a greater feel of it than you do. We also have a very negative press, which does seem to make us want to feel like we all are going to get raped when we leave here, and one in five of us will get murdered. And we're probably having our pockets picked right now. And all the cars, they've already been stolen.
That's only in Liverpool the cars get stolen.
While you're in them. The wheels are taken out from you. And you only park because, you know, you want to eat your pizza because you don't want to break the law or be on the telephone or something.
Yeah, you can't even call the cops while you're in your car getting stolen, because that's against the law, so...
They're probably stealing your phone as well, so...
I saw a video about Liverpool, and it might have just been made up, but there was a blind person performing in front of a crowd to music, and somebody ran and stole his radio while he was doing that. And that apparently was a typical Liverpool thing. Yeah. But it's according to people in Manchester, so who knows?
Yeah, that does sound a little bit like Liverpool, but there's a lot of rivalry between the North and the South anyway, so I don't know, unless it's on YouTube, I don't know if it's true. I wasn't there. Anyone want to buy a radio?
So now, speaking of perceptions and the media, I guess that ties into how people here in England feel about America. Are we a place that is considered safe, unsafe, civilized? Any ideas, thoughts?
I always get nervous when I go to America, especially after 2001, 9/11.
Because of 9/11 or because of the reaction to it?
Well, the first time, before I went to America the first time in 97, I actually watched the film The Warriors. It didn't do much credit for your country, with all the gangs and the roller skates and the hairstyles. I thought it was just a hacker convention, but anyway. I get a little bit nervous, especially with your TSA people and the horror stories you hear about your airports going through scanners and stuff. It does put me off on the return trip. But nothing's going to stop me. I don't have any fear about being killed by terrorists, because it shouldn't stop you doing what you want to do. Because that's freedom, and that's what, if it's your time to go, it's your time to go. So you shouldn't stop you doing anything. Don't give in to terrorism.
Yeah, I'm saying, it does kind of worry a bit going over there, and with getting searched and being on a register and all this kind of stuff, TSA sort of do, I don't know exactly what they do, but it sounds pretty bad. And it wouldn't stop me going over there, but it would sort of affect my choice if it was do I go to America or Canada? Well, I might as well go to Canada then. But also, I think the perception in this country has been changed a lot recently by the Republican presidential race and the absolute craziness that's been going on in that thing. And I don't know what it is. Is one of the candidates saying that women need to have a vaginal probe if they want to have an abortion and all this kind of thing? It's more the politics.
What network are you watching exactly? Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I have been away from the media.
Intravaginal ultrasounds.
Yep.
They must look at an intravaginal ultrasound before making the choice so that they can see how the size and that the heart is beating and all that.
But who's saying this?
I can't remember exactly who. It might be like a Romney Republican thing. It came up. It came up. I don't know the details. We'll have to look it up.
But it was a main candidate. It was somebody who's actually running.
Yes.
Not a
might have been in the. It might have been in the Republican nominations. It came up in that context. I don't know exactly but I don't know that it's now the Republican platform. But it was mm-hmm. part of the whole nomination process. If somebody was pro or supporting it. Whatever.
If it's that early in the game, then they don't believe in evolution either, so there's all kinds of...
The interesting thing about that debate, and obviously you've been following your own news, one, this actually radically increased the cost of performing an abortion. But you have to... This probe machine was really expensive, and they wanted it to be law that you had to have one of these scans first, so it would reduce the number of abortions. And the other thing was, which I saw in a piece in the UK here, was some of the some of the pro-abortion groups were actually being sponsored by the anti-abortion groups, and they would get the girls to come in and then try and brainwash them to keep their child. That's just crazy.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, well, that's definitely something we should look into some more. That's things we can learn. Anything else about America that stands out? It seems to me that the hesitation to come to the country because of the intrusion of privacy, to someone from England, it seems like you'd almost welcome that, because cameras and fingerprints and scanning and searching keeps you safe, right?
Well, you see, we do have cameras in this country and lots of them, but as far as fingerprinting, DNA testing, if you get caught for a criminal offence, you'll have that, but generally as a population we don't have mass fingerprinting, mass DNA tests and all this kind of thing.
But don't you think it would be a relatively soft sell to the public to get them to believe that would make them safer?
Possibly. I mean, they've tried it in the past. I can't remember. I think it was the one of the Conservative candidates was saying that everyone should have their DNA taken just so they could detect more criminal offences, which is absolutely ludicrous, because you'd have everyone who was DNA tested would be the people who wouldn't do any crime. All the criminals would just find some way around it, and you'd never solve any more crime either. So it's just ridiculous, really.
Actually, that's worked against them, because the bigger the database, the more longer it takes to go through it. If you just had proper criminals on the database, it'd be a lot easier. But if you get arrested, they'll take your DNA. So if you get arrested before you go back, we can arrange to get your DNA in.
Oh, and just FYI, if you actually do get arrested, they will take your fingerprints, obviously, your DNA, and then afterwards, they won't destroy it. There's been a big debate over here, and I can't remember what happened on it, maybe Crip can fill in some blanks here, but yeah, if you were not even charged, they would keep your DNA on the database. And it wasn't until someone went through the legal hassle for a number of years that they actually got their DNA removed from the database. But they'd been convicted of no crime, not even charged, and their DNA was kept on the database, as is everyone else's.
Actually, that was David Murray. He's a journalist, and he got arrested because he looks like a terrorist. He's got that sort of darky type skin. He's actually French. Pulled out a phone while going down in an underground. I don't know if it was after 2007 sometime, after the bombings. Sort of knee-jerk reaction to that crisis. And he was actually fighting to get his DNA off the database because it would be on the database for 100 years. So basically his lifetime. And he managed to get his DNA removed from the database because he was innocent. And it's a question of if you're innocent, they should really remove the database. If you're not charged with, convicted of a crime, then really your DNA should be removed because you are innocent.
Makes sense. Makes total sense. All right, well, we're kind of wrapping it up. I think Big Ben's about to chime again, and when it does, we will have heard all four permutations of its chiming. This is a quarter after now. So let me just wrap up by asking about healthcare, because we haven't talked about this. Tell me something about healthcare in the UK as far as what you guys get. What's the worst that can happen as far as anything you have to spend? We can tell you about the United States. It's a nightmare, as you might have heard. But what's it like here, for real?
Well, I mean, up until recently, even now, we have a completely free health system. Supposedly completely free. And there we go. All four of them.
We weren't going to mention it.
Oh, sorry. But yeah, I mean, basically in the 60s, we brought in the National Health Service, which was basically everyone was entitled to free healthcare, no matter what your illness, no matter what your age, sort of like race, gender. Everyone had completely covered for every single sort of like facet of healthcare. Now, you know, recently the Tory government has just brought in a bill which is going to split up the National Health Service into smaller sort of like patient care groups, which is probably then going to be sold off to private companies. Now what's going to happen is the private companies are going to focus more on the kind of therapeutic health benefits, which is more profitable for them. And then, you know, it's not going to really work as well for like pensioners with cancer and these sort of like terminal illnesses, which are a lot more serious. They're going to have to be sort of like sponsored by government a lot more, which, you know, essentially means that, you know, although there will be a sort of like National Health Service which will sponsor you for sort of like the terminal illnesses and everything like that, they're probably going to very soon make it so that you're going to have to pay for therapeutic costs. So anything like, you know, if you break your leg or something like that and you're going to get better, that will be sorted out by private healthcare because they know that they can make some money out of that off you. We're kind of like going more into the kind of like grain of, you know, paying for health services, which there has been a large sort of like controversy about in this country already, and it's probably only going to get worse.
Well, right now at this moment, how much do you have to pay for anything?
Zero generally, but
At the moment, it's free at the point of use. Apart from prescriptions, which you have to pay £7.30 if you want some pills.
You have to pay £7.30 for
some pills. So if you've got the most expensive pills known to man, if you're out of work or you don't work, you're retired, then it's free, or obviously if you're a child. At the moment, no. I mean, there's a number of myths about healthcare in the UK. I mean, in dentistry, we've had a private system running alongside the public system for a long, 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 long time, and it's very well established. I think this country has got a very bloated, inefficient public health service, and I don't agree with completely privatising it. I think that would be wrong, but keeping it in the public domain as it is, it costs way too much damn money. So if we could find a happy medium, which we won't, we'll get it wrong, we'll go either fully private or massive bloated monstrosity.
When you say it costs too much,
how much do people, who's paying and how? Through taxes?
It's through, your income taxes. We spend about as much on our armed forces as we do on healthcare, which is not that one's any better than the other, but that, to give you a perspective of what we're spending, that's a lot of money.
Well, actually, I would say spending money on healthcare is a lot better than spending it on an army to go and blow up people, you know, because if you spend it too much on the army to go up, blow up people, you just have to spend more on healthcare to go and fix them again. So,
and the people that you blow up might not have healthcare to start with.
Exactly, you know. This is
I was just giving an example of scale and size.
Sure.
Not that one is any better than the other. That's not what I was getting at.
So what percentage of tax do you wind up paying?
It's your national insurance contribution, which is 10%.
10% of your income goes to insurance?
Yes,
10%. Something like that.
I think it's 12%. I think it's 12%.
And then on top of that, you pay what other kind of tax on your income?
Well, the other taxes you pay, which is 20% or going up to 50% depending, goes to different pots, goes into different things. The actual NHS comes out of the national insurance contribution.
So let's say I'm just, you know, an average person making an average wage. What percentage of tax could I expect to pay?
Probably about 20 to 25% maximum, I think.
Well, I think 32% is what your total tax.
Well, that's less than we pay in the States. Only 33% for moderately well-off people.
Yes, but then we pay 20% value-added tax on every single thing we buy. And you can't.
Well, that's sales tax. Yeah, that's different.
It's still tax.
All right, and that's 20%. We pay something like 8%. Okay.
And then we have tax just to drive on the road. You know, we have tax just to get in a car. Forget the cost of the car, forget the fuel, forget toll roads. We have a tax just to get into the vehicle and sit on a public highway.
You have trains.
What are those?
You have trains and you can go places anywhere in the country.
I'm not familiar with public transport.
Well, okay, but it's there if you need it. And that's another thing I think you guys have that works fairly well.
Yeah. In London, I am very impressed with the public transportation system. I'm not from London, but as you move out into the other parts of the country, as I'm sure it's the same in America, it becomes very infrequent and very expensive to get around, so you have to have a car.
I mean, you in New York have the subway system there, which is an awesome way of getting around New York, but as we have the underground here, but further out into the country, you're going to be struggling for public transport, which is kind of the same in Britain. In major towns and cities, public transport works very, very well. If you get out into the countryside, you're going to be struggling, really.
Yeah, I mean, basically our transport system is, the tubes close at 12. So if you're trying to get a late tube home, after 12 you're stuck, you have to get something called a night bus. But we have got a very good night bus network, so yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about sort of the scene here, young people sort of making things change. We heard a little bit about some of the Occupy stuff that had happened here in London, and I was talking to Crypt a little earlier about some of the spaces, and that, you know, we were noticing what spaces there were and what what's going on. And he told me something really interesting. He said there is a really rather large space here in the city of London, not as many spaces as you might see in other big cities in the U.S., but he had told me that their registration, their membership is, I think, on the order of about 400 people. Is that true, Crip?
Yeah, we have the Hackspace here, which is basically we have, I think it's 470 members now, which is probably about the largest Hackspace membership in the world, at least that we can find. So we haven't got the largest space in the world, but we've got the largest membership, which can lead to problems sometimes, but, you know, it's a really awesome place if you want to come check it out.
And these are really important groups to, because this is kind of the crux of the people being aware and making things sort of change and doing creative things to kind of move things along and change the way society works a little bit. Or at least getting the message out. And I was wondering is there anything going on? Like, what kinds of things other than sort of the Occupy Wall Street stuff? I know this summer actually is incredibly rich with events and things going on. Is there anything you might want to let us know about?
I mean, like, we've obviously got the Hackspace. The idea of the Hackspace is that you kind of, like, bring people there and give them the tools and get them to make what they want. And, you know, this has been tremendously successful in London. So what we're doing this summer, end of August, is we're doing a camp, outside camp, called EMF Camp, Electromagnetic Field, which is a bit of a lame name, but hell. But basically, we're taking kind of inspiration from CCC Camp, R Camp in Netherlands. And what we're doing is creating a large space, which is going to be, you know, we've seen these other camps, and what they do really well is they create a huge community and get people really excited about things. So we're doing the same thing in Britain, but we're going to be focused more on doing workshops, giving the people the tools and getting them involved in projects to go and build things for themselves and try and get them to do that. So there will be talks there, and we're going to have lots of talks about different projects. But the main focus of the camp is going to be creating a community spirit, creating like workshops, and just giving people space to do whatever they want. Because one of the things about the London Hack Space that we've been really surprised about is we started off doing mainly kind of electronics and computer security and doing programming there. And then we had people come in bringing lathes, we've got laser cutters there. We've even got knitting machines. We've had people coming doing knitting projects,
wow,
which has been really awesome. And
that's so good.
Just to see people come there with their own ideas and build stuff. You know, so we wanted to do this as a large weekend event, which is happening in Milton Keynes on the 31st of August to the 2nd of September.
So you have a location picked out now?
Yeah, it's a location called Pineham, which is a field in Milton Keynes. You can go to the website emfcamp.org, so we've got all the information on there. But yeah, it's just about creating that space where people can just come and do whatever the hell they want and be creative in their own way. And that's what we really want to encourage as both sort of like the organisation of EMF Camp and the London Hack Space and everything that's going on around that. That's the kind of the direction we're going in.
And hopefully that spreads into the community proper and maybe non-traditional hacker types, and the rest of the community will take up that spirit as it spreads. So.
Yeah. Any final words from you guys? Zap, good, Bob?
No, I haven't got anything. I think we've covered most of it.
Hey, America. Catch you later.
EMF Camp is going to be totally awesome. It's modelled on CAR and CCDC. You might never have been to one, but you've heard about them, so come on down.
Well, I just wanted to thank you all very, very much for your hospitality and the good conversation. You guys have showed us around a bit, given us, a crash course in the real London, kind of how it is and how to navigate, how to get around, what it's all about. And we really do feel like we got to see a bit of it through your eyes and hear your perspectives. And I really appreciate all the help that you guys were able to give us, kind of understanding surveillance and the attitude behind it, and just some of the things that are a bit counterintuitive, stuff we hadn't really expected. You know, we had a bit of our own preconceptions about surveillance and the culture around that, and I think things are always different when you get to kind of get the colloquial perspective, what real people in that area feel about it, and I'm left with a unique view, and I don't know, I'm a lot more open. I think I'd be more willing to come back and show my face instead of wearing a bandana over my face as I was when I got off the plane. So
yeah, that caused a bit of a stir, but I think you're a lot more comfortable now.
Yeah, absolutely.
As are the people around us. Okay, that's it from the base of Big Ben, across the street actually, where there are no surveillance cameras watching us that we know of, but I'm sure there's all kinds of motion detectors and microphones in addition to ours. That's it for Off the Wall this week. Good night.
Revolutionary days were sadly over, and a cool profile down Labyrinth Grove won't make it no more. You could wake up in a doorway. London's brilliant when it's raining, everybody's moaning and complaining. London's dismal and divine, and I know one day it's gonna be. Mine eyes have seen the gory faces of those bitter men and their body talk. And that's not all. Every night before I close my eyes, I say a prayer to my desires, hung up on a
It is a Tuesday night. It is just about 7:04 in the p.m. And you're listening to WUSB Stony Brook, and that can only mean one thing, Finn's Revolution until 9 p.m. My name is Finn. We shall be listening to, oh, I don't know, the strange, the new, the bad, beautiful, all those things. Stay tuned.
Local dance was passing by the door. A large effect would echo on the floor. Above the band, my voice was heard. Quite suddenly, it had occurred to me, I'm bored. I'm bored with everything I touch and see. I'm bored with exposés of LSD. I'm bored with Frank Sinatra's new LP, and so I roared. I'm bored. Drinking different colored wines or beer.
Chug-a-lug, chug-a-lug.
Just quite frankly leaves me bored to
tears for souvenirs.
And quite apart from what one hears, I've been like this for years and years, you see. Ennui. I'm bored.
I'm bored, I'm bored.
With Mother Nature or her son, I'm bored.
I'm bored, I'm bored.
With everything that should be done. And so,
I'm bored, I'm bored.
I just poke out my big red tongue and I'm bored!
I'm tired of art!
Drawing bored.
Sex is a drag!
In a boarding house, I dare say.
Ha! Australians bore me!
You mean air bore originals, Dantron?
I'm bored to death!
Like mortar bored.
I am bored, I am bored. can afford by Cyril Paul.
I hate each Julie Andrews film they've made. I'm just a nasty, narrow-minded jade. Don't think that I will smile at it. I'm not a weak-willed hypocrite, I'll say. I'm bored. I'm bored.
I'm bored, I'm bored.
With withered men and spotty ties who hum to some tune like Edelweiss. I'm bored.
I'm bored, I'm bored.
And when I hear it in a trice, I shout, I'm bored.
The only thing that ever interests me is me.
Me, 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 me.
Shade!
It's me, 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 me,
don't care what the little bird sings. We go down with the dew in the morning light. The tree don't know what the little bird brings. We go down with the dew in the morning and we breathe it in. There is no need to forgive. Breathe it in. There is no need